Meditations on First Philosophy by René Descartes. First published in 1641. Third Meditation. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Third Meditation, On God. I will now shut my eyes, block my ears, cut off all my senses. I will regard all my mental images of bodily things as empty, false, and worthless. If I could, I would clear them out of my mind altogether. I will get into conversation with myself, examine myself more deeply, and try in this way gradually to know myself more intimately. I am a thing that thinks, i.e., that doubts, affirms, denies, wills, refuses, understands some things, and is ignorant of many others. This thing also imagines and has sensory perceptions, for, as I remarked before, even if the objects of my sensory experience and imagination don't exist outside me, nevertheless, sensory perception and imagination themselves, considered simply as mental events, certainly do occur in me. That lists everything that I truly know, or at least everything I have so far discovered that I know. Now, I will look more carefully to see whether I have overlooked other facts about myself. I am certain that I am a thinking thing. Doesn't that tell me what it takes for me to be certain about anything? In this first item of knowledge, there is simply a vivid and clear perception of what I am asserting. This wouldn't be enough to make me certain of its truth, if it could ever turn out that something I perceived so vividly and clearly was false. So I now seem to be able to lay it down as a general rule that whatever I perceive very vividly and clearly is true. I previously accepted as perfectly certain and evident many things that I afterwards realized were doubtful. The earth, sky, stars, and everything else that I took in through the senses. But in those cases, what I perceived clearly were merely the ideas or thoughts of those things that came into my mind. And I am still not denying that those ideas occur within me. But I also used to believe that my ideas came from things outside that resembled them in all respects. Indeed, I believed this for so long that I wrongly came to think that I perceived it clearly. In fact, it was false. Or anyway, if it was true, it was not due to the strength of my perceptions. But what about when I was considering something simple and straightforward in arithmetic or geometry, for example, that 2 + 3 = 5. Didn't I see these things clearly enough to accept them as true? Indeed, the only reason I could find for doubting them was this. Perhaps some God could have made me so as to be deceived even in those matters that seemed most obvious. Whenever I bring to mind my old belief in the supreme power of God, I have to admit that God could, if he wanted to, easily make me go wrong, even about things that I think I see perfectly clearly. But when I turn my thought onto the things themselves, the ones I think I perceive clearly, I find them so convincing that I spontaneously exclaim, "Let him do his best to deceive me. He will never bring it about that I am nothing while I think I am something, or make it true in the future that I have never existed, given that I do now exist, or bring it about that 2 + 3 = more or less than 5, or anything else like this in which I see a plain contradiction. Also, since I have no evidence that there is a deceiving God, and don't even know for sure that there is a God at all, the reason for doubt based purely on this supposition of a deceiving God is a very slight and theoretical one. However, I shall want to remove even this slight reason for doubt, so when I get the opportunity, I shall examine whether there is a God, and, if there is, whether he can be a deceiver. If I don't settle this, it seems then I can never be quite certain about anything else. First, if I am to proceed in an orderly way, I should classify my thoughts into definite kinds, and ask which kinds can properly be said to be true or false. Some of my thoughts are, so to speak, images or pictures of things, as when I think of a man, or a chimera, or the sky, or an angel, or God, and strictly speaking, these are the only thoughts that should be called ideas. Other thoughts have more to them than that. For example, when I want something, or am afraid, or affirm, or deny, my thought represents some particular thing, but it also includes something more than merely the likeness of that thing. Some thoughts in this category are called volitions or emotions, while others are called judgments. When ideas are considered solely in themselves, and not taken to be connected to anything else, they can't be false. For whether it is a goat that I am imagining, or a chimera, either way it is true that I do imagine it. Nor is there falsity in the will or the emotions. For even if the things I want are wicked or non-existent, it is still true that I want them. All that is left, the only kind of thought where I must watch out for mistakes, are judgments. And their most common mistake is to judge that my ideas resemble things outside me. Of course, if I considered the ideas themselves simply as aspects of my thought, and not as connected to anything else, they could hardly lead me into error. Some of my ideas seem to be innate, some to be caused from the outside, and others to have been invented by me. As I see it, my understanding of what a thing is, what truth is, and what thought is, derives purely from my own nature, which means that it is innate. My hearing a noise, or seeing the sun, or feeling the fire, comes from things outside me. And sirens, hippogriffs, and the like, are my own invention. But perhaps really all my ideas are caused from the outside, or all are innate, or all are made up, for I still have not clearly perceived their true origin. But my main question now concerns the ideas that I take to come from things outside me. Why do I think they resemble these things? Nature has apparently taught me to think that they do. But also I know from experience that these ideas don't depend on my will, and thus don't depend simply on me. They often come into my mind without my willing them to. Right now, for example, I have a feeling of warmth, whether I want to or not. And that leads me to think that this sensation or idea of heat comes from something other than myself, namely the heat of a fire I am sitting by. And it seems natural to suppose that what comes to me from that external thing will be like it rather than unlike it. Now let me see if these arguments are strong enough. When I say, nature taught me to think this, all I mean is that I have spontaneous impulse to believe it, not that I am shown its truth by some natural light. There is a great difference between those. Things that are revealed by the natural light, for example, that if I am doubting then I exist, are not open to any doubt, because no other faculty that might refute them could be as trustworthy as the natural light. My natural impulses, however, have no such privilege. I have often come to think that they had led me astray on moral questions, and I don't see any reason to trust them in other things. Then again, although these ideas don't depend on my will, it doesn't follow that they must come from things located outside me. Perhaps they come from some faculty of mine other than my will, one that I don't fully know about, which produces these ideas without help from external things. This is, after all, just how I have always thought ideas are produced in me when I am dreaming. Similarly, the natural impulses I have been talking about, though they seem opposed to my will, come from within me, which provides evidence that I can cause things that my will does not cause. Finally, even if these ideas do come from things other than myself, it doesn't follow that they must resemble those things. Indeed, I think I have often discovered objects to be very unlike my ideas of them. For example, I find within me two different ideas of the sun. One seems to come from the senses. It is a prime example of an idea that I reckon to have an external source, and it makes the sun appear very small. The other is based on astronomical reasoning, i.e., it is based on notions that are innate in me, or else it is constructed by me in some other way. and it shows the sun to be much larger than the earth. Obviously these ideas cannot both resemble the external sun, and reason convinces me that the former idea, the one that seems to have come most directly from the sun itself, in fact does not resemble it at all. These considerations show that it isn't reliable judgment, of merely some blind impulse that has led me to think that there are things outside me that give ideas or likenesses of themselves through the sense organs or in some other way. Perhaps, though, there is another way of investigating whether some of the things I have ideas of really do exist outside me. Considered simply as mental events, my ideas seem to be on a par. They all appear to come from inside me in the same way. But considered as images representing things other than themselves, it is clear that they differ widely. Undoubtedly, the ideas that represent substances amount to something more. They contain within themselves more representative reality than do the ideas that merely represent modes or qualities. Again, the idea that provides my understanding of a supreme God, eternal, infinite, unchangeable, omniscient, omnipotent, and the creator of everything that exists except for himself, certainly has in it more representative reality than the ideas that represent merely finite substances. Now, it is obvious by the natural light that the total cause of something must contain at least as much reality as does the effect. For where could the effect get its reality from, if not from the cause? And how could the cause give reality to the effect, unless it first had that reality itself? Two things follow from this. Something can't arise from nothing, and what is more perfect, that is, contains in itself more reality, can't arise from what is less perfect. And this is plainly true, not only for actual or intrinsic reality, as philosophers call it, but also for the representative reality of ideas, that is, the reality that an idea represents. A stone, for example, can begin to exist only if it is produced by something that contains, either straightforwardly or in some higher form, everything that is to be found in the stone. Similarly, heat can't be produced in a previously cold object except by something of at least the same order of perfection as heat, and so on. But it is also true that the idea of heat or of a stone can be caused in me only by something that contains at least as much reality as I conceive to be in the heat or in the stone. For although this cause does not transfer any of its actual or intrinsic reality to my idea, it still can't be less real. An idea need have no intrinsic reality except what it derives from my thought, of which it is a mode or quality. But any idea that has representative reality must surely come from a cause that contains at least as much intrinsic reality as there is representative reality in the idea. For if we suppose that an idea contains something that was not in its cause, it must have acquired this from nothing. Yet the kind of reality that is involved in something's being represented in the mind by an idea, though it may not be very perfect, certainly isn't nothing, and so it can't come from nothing. The reality I am considering in my ideas is merely representative, but I ought not to think that the idea's cause might also have that reality only representatively and not intrinsically. If it did, that would mean that the cause is itself an idea, because only ideas have representative reality. But that would be wrong. Although one idea may perhaps originate from another, there can't be an infinite regress of such ideas. Eventually the regress must get back to an idea, whose cause is not an idea, and this cause must be a kind of archetype, a pattern or model from which copies are made, containing intrinsically all the reality or perfection that the idea contains only representatively. So the natural light makes it clear to me that my ideas are like pictures or images that can easily fall short of the perfection of the things from which they are taken, but which can't exceed it. The longer and more carefully I examine all these points, the more vividly and clearly I recognize their truth. But what is my conclusion to be? If I find that some idea of mine has so much representative reality that I am sure the same reality doesn't reside in me, either straightforwardly or in a higher form, then I myself can't be the cause of that idea. But everything in the world must have some cause. So the idea I am speaking of must have a cause other than myself, from which it follows that I am not alone in the world. If no such idea is to be found in me, I shall have no argument to show that anything exists apart from myself. For, despite a most careful and wide-ranging survey, this is the only argument I have so far been able to find. Setting aside the idea of giving me a representation of myself, which can't present any difficulty in this context, I have ideas that represent God, inanimate bodies, angels, animals, and finally, other men like myself. As regards my ideas of other men, or animals, or angels, I can easily understand that they could be assembled from the ideas I have of myself, of bodies and of God, even if the world contained no men but me, no animals and no angels. As to my ideas of bodies, so far as I can see, they contain nothing so great or excellent that it couldn't have originated within myself. For if I examine them thoroughly, one by one, as I did the idea of the wax yesterday, I realize that the following short list gives everything I perceive vividly and clearly in them. Size, or extension in length, breadth, and depth. Shape, which is a function of the boundaries of this extension. Position, which is a relation among various items possessing shape. Motion, or change in position. To these may be added substance, duration, and number. But as for all the rest, including light and colours, sounds, smells, tastes, heat and cold, and other qualities known by touch, I think of them in such a confused and obscure way that I don't even know whether they are true or false, that is, whether my ideas of them are ideas of real things or of non-things. Strictly speaking, only judgments can be true or false, but we can also speak of an idea as false in a certain sense. We call it materially false, if it represents a non-thing as a thing. For example, my ideas of heat and cold have so little clarity and distinctness that they don't enable me to know whether cold is merely the absence of heat, or heat is merely the absence of cold, or heat and cold are both real positive qualities, or neither heat nor cold is a real positive quality. If the right answer is that cold is nothing but the absence of heat, the idea that represents it to me as something real and positive deserves to be called false. And the same goes for other ideas of this kind. Such ideas obviously don't have to be caused by something other than myself. If they are false, that is, if they represent non-things, then they are in me only because of a deficiency or lack of perfection in my nature, which is to say that they arise from nothing. I know this by the natural light. If, on the other hand, they are true, I see no reason why they shouldn't arise from myself, since they present me with such a low degree of reality that I can't distinguish the thing they represent from a non-thing. With regard to the vivid and clear elements in my ideas of bodies, it appears that I could have borrowed some of these from my idea of myself, namely, substance, duration, number, and anything else of this kind. For example, I think that a stone is a substance, or is a thing capable of existing independently, and I also think that I am a substance. Admittedly, I conceive of myself as a thing that thinks and isn't extended, and of the stone as a thing that is extended and doesn't think, so that the two conceptions differ enormously. But they seem to have the classification substance in common. Again, I perceive that I now exist, and remember that I have existed for some time. Moreover, I have various thoughts that I can count. It is in these ways that I acquire the ideas of duration and number, which I can then transfer to other things. As for all the other elements that make up the ideas of bodies, extension, shape, position, and movement, these are not straightforwardly contained in me, since I am nothing but a thinking thing. But since they are merely modes of a substance, and I am a substance, it seems possible that they are contained in me in some higher form. So there remains only the idea of God. Is there anything in that which couldn't have originated in myself? By the word God, I understand a substance that is infinite, eternal, unchangeable, independent, supremely intelligent, supremely powerful, which created me and anything else that may exist. The more carefully I concentrate on these attributes, the less possible it seems that any of them could have originated from me alone. So this whole discussion implies that God necessarily exists. It is true that my being a substance explains my having the idea of substance, but it does not explain my having the idea of an infinite substance. That must come from some substance that is itself infinite. I am finite. You might reject this on the ground that my notion of the infinite is arrived at merely by negating the finite, just as my conceptions of rest and darkness are arrived at by negating movement and light. That would be a mistake, however. I clearly understand that there is more reality in an infinite substance than in a finite one, and hence that my perception of the infinite, i.e. God, is in some way prior to my perception of the finite, i.e. myself. Whenever I know that I doubt something or want something, I understand that I lack something, and am therefore not wholly perfect. How could I grasp this, unless I had an idea of a more perfect being that enabled me to recognize my own defects by comparison? Nor can it be said that perhaps this idea of God is materially false, and thus have come from nothing, as may be the case, I noted this a few moments ago, with the ideas of heat and cold. On the contrary, it is utterly vivid and clear, and contains in itself more representative reality than any other idea. That is, it stands for something that is grander, more powerful, more real than any other idea stands for. So it is more true, less open to the suspicion of falsehood than any other idea. This idea of a supremely perfect and infinite being is, I say, true in the highest degree. For although one might imagine that such a being does not exist, it can't be supposed that the idea of such a being represents something unreal in the way the idea of cold perhaps does. The idea is, moreover, utterly vivid and clear. It does not matter that I don't grasp the infinite, or that there are countless additional attributes of God that I can't grasp, and perhaps can't even touch in my thought. For it is in the nature of the infinite not to be grasped by a finite being like myself. It is enough that I understand the infinite, and that I judge that God has, either straightforwardly or in some higher form, all the attributes I clearly perceive and know to imply some perfection, and perhaps countless others of which I am ignorant. This is enough to make the idea I have of God the most true, vivid, and clear of all my ideas. Here is a possible objection to that line of thought. Perhaps I am greater than I myself understand. Perhaps all the perfections that I attribute to God are ones I do have in some potential form, and they merely haven't yet shown themselves in actuality. My knowledge is gradually increasing, and I see no obstacle to its continuing to do so to infinity. I might then be able to use this increased and eventually infinite knowledge to acquire all the other perfections of God. In that case, I already have the potentiality for these perfections. Why shouldn't this potentiality be enough to enable me to have caused the idea of them, that is, to have caused my idea of God? But all this is impossible for three reasons. First, though it is true that my knowledge is increasing, and that I have many potentialities that are not yet actual, this is all quite irrelevant to the idea of God, which contains absolutely nothing that is potential. Indeed, this gradual increase in knowledge is itself the surest sign of imperfection, because if I am learning more, that shows that there are things I don't know, and this is an imperfection in me. Secondly, even if my knowledge increases forever, it will never actually be infinite, since it will never reach the point where it isn't capable of a further increase. God, on the other hand, I take to be actually infinite, so that nothing can be added to his perfection. And, thirdly, strictly speaking, potential being is nothing. What it takes to cause a representative being of an idea is actual being. If one concentrates carefully, all this is quite evident by the natural light. But when I relax my concentration, and my mental vision is blurred by the images of things I perceive by the senses, I lose sight of the reasons why my idea of more perfect being has to come from a being that really is more perfect. So I want to push on with my inquiry, now asking a new question. If the more perfect being didn't exist, could I exist? Well, if God didn't exist, from what would I derive my existence? It would have to come from myself, or from my parents, or from some other beings less perfect than God. A being more perfect than God, or even one equally perfect, is unthinkable. If I had derived my existence from myself, I would not now doubt or want or lack anything at all, for I would have given myself every perfection I have any idea of. So I would be God. I mustn't suppose that the items I lack would be harder to get than the ones I now have. On the contrary, acquiring knowledge of the many things I'm ignorant about would merely be giving a certain substance, myself, certain qualities, which would have been much less difficult than for this thinking substance to emerge out of nothing. If I had derived my existence from myself, the greater achievement, I certainly wouldn't have denied myself the knowledge in question, which would be much easier to acquire than my existence. Nor would I have denied myself any of the attributes I perceive to be contained in the idea of God, none of which seem any harder to achieve than the knowledge I have been speaking of. Here is a thought that might seem to undercut that argument. Perhaps I have always existed as I do now. Then wouldn't it follow that there need be no cause for my existence? No, it does not follow. For a lifespan can be divided into countless parts, each completely independent of the others, so that from my existing at one time, it doesn't follow that I exist at later times, unless some cause keeps me in existence. One might say that it creates me afresh at each moment. Anyone who thinks hard about the nature of time will understand that what it takes to bring a thing into existence is also needed to keep it in existence at each moment of its duration. So there's no real distinction between preservation and creation, only a conceptual one. And this is something the natural light makes evident. So I have to ask myself, whether I have the power to bring it about that I, who now exist, will still exist a minute from now. For since I am nothing but a thinking thing, or anyway, that is the only part of me that I am now concerned with, if I had such power, I would undoubtedly be aware of it. But I experience no such power. And this shows me quite clearly that for my continued existence, I depend on some being other than myself. Perhaps this being is not God, though. Perhaps I was produced by causes less perfect than God, such as my parents. No. For as I have said before, it is quite clear that there must be at least as much reality or perfection in the cause as in the effect. And therefore, given that I am a thinking thing, and have within me some idea of God, the cause of me, whatever it is, must itself be a thinking thing, and must have the idea of all the perfections I attribute to God. What is the cause of this cause of me? If it is the cause of its own existence, then it is God. For if it has the power of existing through its own strength, then undoubtedly it also has the power of actually possessing all the perfections that it has an idea of, that is, all the perfections I conceive to be in God. If, on the other hand, it derives its existence from another cause, then the question arises all over again regarding this further cause. Does it, get its existence from itself or from another cause? Eventually we must reach the ultimate cause, and this will be God. It is clear enough that this sequence of causes can't run back to infinity, especially since I am dealing with the cause that not only produced me in the past, but also preserves me at the present moment. One might think this: several partial causes contributed to my creation. I received from one cause my idea of one of the perfections I attribute to God, my idea of another perfection from another cause, and so on through the list. Each perfection is to be found somewhere in the universe, but no one thing has them all. That can't be right, because God's simplicity, that is, the unity or inseparability of all his attributes, is one of the most important of the perfections that I understand him to have. Anything that gave me the idea of his perfections as united in a single substance must also have given me the ideas of the perfections themselves. No cause could have made me understand that the perfections are united without at the same time showing me what they are. So my ideas of the various perfections that I attribute to God must have come from a single cause, not from a scatter of different causes. Lastly, as regards my parents, even if everything I have ever believed about them is true, it is certainly not they who keep me in existence. In so far as I am a thinking thing, indeed, they did not even make me. They merely brought about an arrangement of matter that I have always regarded as containing me, that is, containing my mind, for that is all I now take myself to be. So my parents can't be the cause of me that I am inquiring about. Thus I conclude that the mere fact that I exist and have within me an idea of a most perfect being, that is God, provides a clear proof that God does indeed exist. It remains for me only to ask how I received this idea from God. I didn't get it from the senses. It has never come to me unexpectedly, as do most of the ideas that occur when I seem to see and touch and hear things. And it's not something that I invented either, for clearly I can't take anything away from it or add anything to it. When an idea is sheerly invented, the inventor is free to add a bit here, subtract a bit there, but my idea of God is a natural unit that doesn't permit such interference. The only remaining alternative is that my idea of God is innate in me, just as the idea of myself is innate in me. It is no surprise that God, in creating me, should have placed this idea in me to serve as a mark of the craftsman stamped on his work. The mark need not be anything distinct from the work itself. But the mere fact that God created me makes it very believable that I am somehow made in his image and likeness, and that I perceive this likeness in the same way that I perceive myself. That is, when I turn my mind's eye upon myself, I understand that I am a thing that is incomplete and dependent on something else, and aspires without limit to ever greater and better things. But at the same time, I understand that he on whom I depend has within him all those greater things, not just indefinitely, but infinitely, not just potentially, but actually, and hence that he is God. The core of the argument is this: I couldn't exist with the nature that I have, that is, containing within me the idea of God, if God didn't really exist. By God, I mean the very being the idea of whom is within me, the one with no defects and all those perfections that I can't grasp, but can somehow touch with my thought. This shows clearly that it is not possible for him to be a deceiver, since the natural light makes it clear that all fraud and deception depend on some defect. But before examining this point more carefully, and investigating other truths that may be derived from it, I want to pause here, and spend some time contemplating God, to reflect on his attributes, and to gaze with wonder and adoration on the beauty of this immense light, so far as the eye of my darkened intellect can bear it. For just as we believe through faith that the supreme happiness of the next life consists in contemplating the divine majesty, so experience tells us that this same contemplation, though much less perfect, provides the greatest joy we can have in this life. End of third meditation.